Okay. You ready?
Yeah, let's do this.
Disruptive Peacemakers.
You are listening to the Disruptive Peacemakers podcast, a podcast that asks the question, what is peace? What is a peacemaker? And how can peacemaking be disruptive? One that interrupts injustice, that disarms evil, and takes on the arduous and ongoing pursuit of racial reconciliation and racial justice.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the Disruptive Peacemakers podcast. This is John Williams, and my co-host
is Erin Takeuchi. Hello, everyone.
Hey,
John.
Erin,
John, I'm so excited.
Why are you excited?
Because we have a wonderful guest today.
Who's
she
guest?
Is an Asian sister.
Yes.
And she's a powerful sister.
Yes.
A little shy sometimes, but man, she's got some good stuff to share with us.
Yes.
So yeah, I want to introduce Miss Eileen Kim. Welcome, Eileen.
Thank you. Thank you guys for having me. I'm so honored.
We're so happy to have you on, and I've been looking forward to spending this time with you, interviewing you and letting the world know more about you. And yes, you do have such a powerful voice, and I think people need to hear from you, and they will definitely hear more from you. So let's go ahead and just start from the top then. Eileen, tell us a little bit about yourself, whatever you feel so inclined to share to let everybody know who you are.
Yeah. So I am Korean American. I am an attorney in the realm of public service and born and raised in SoCal, spent a little bit of time in Seattle, and mostly my heartbeat is for the incarcerated population. And that's kind of where I've done some work during and after law school. I think a lot of what I've done in recent years is to kind of delve into self-study and activism engagement in terms of what that looks like for, just promoting Black liberation. And on top of which, I am the proud aunt to Brandon and Allison. Shout out to them.
Yes, that's amazing. That's so cool. So it's clear that you have deep passions, and just knowing you, that I know that a big passion, two of your big passions is talking about anti-Blackness, as well as talking about incarceration. And we'll delve into the incarceration component first. What led you into wanting to do this kind of work?
Yeah. So I had really the great honor of representing an incarcerated person for his parole hearing as a second year law student while I was out in Boston. And it was this clinical course called the Prisoner's Rights Clinic. And I remember being terrified. and I almost backed out, but I had a good friend who kind of like crossed his name out and let me be the last one to sign up. It was the best thing that I could have done. And it was sort of like this 3 months whirlwind of, visiting my client at the prison, I think once or twice a week, just like getting him ready for his hearing. And I think for me, that was really sort of this eye opener of, this particular world, like people literally being thrown away in cages and being deemed disposable to society because of their actions. And just, I think being given the chance to speak on his behalf really forced me to do something which I have a hard time doing, which is to put myself to the side, right? To kind of put those fears in the corner where they belong and to be able to stand up for another person in dishonoring their dignity, their value as a human being. And it was really ever since then that I felt like, all my internships after that were like representing criminal defendants at their bail hearings or like record sealing hearings. And, I think too, if I'm honest, a lot of that kind of comes from a personal context of having experienced a lot of what it feels like to be confined, and sort of like family trauma in that way. And that in no way is to compare my experience to what it is to actually be incarcerated, right, in a cage. But I think there's a level of compassion there. Some of that is really familiar in terms of, the psychological effects of that. So, I think for me, engaging in activism has helped me understand that a lot of this work is about discovering self-love. It is about doing the work for yourself and examining your sort of internal life as much as it is about sort of getting proximate to other people and speaking up on their behalf. So,
Eileen, can you speak a little bit more on what you were talking about, like this place where you came from of being confined? Because I think that, right, it's all of these things, these experiences that make up who we are and the direction that we face, and then the hands, where we open our hands up to in trying to do right and trying to do good and trying to do justice. Can you speak on that a little bit?
Absolutely. I think, it's not sort of like the happy, comfortable people who do this kind of work, right? This is really more often than not someone who knows a little bit about pain, and I think for me, this is in no way like pointing fingers at any of the people who I grew up with or the environment that I was raised in. None of that, right? I think every part of it was critical to getting me to this point. So if anything, I'm grateful. And obviously, like, it took many years for me to get to that point in saying that, but I am nonetheless. And so, I think this speaks very directly to this idea of being a woman of color, and specifically a Korean woman, right? So in that particular social location, specifically as Korean, specifically as female, I think the cocktail mix that you find there is the silencing of the voice. That's huge. And for me, that was sort of like a centerpiece issue. I know a lot of what it is to be silenced, to be ignored, and to be neglected. And again, it's sort of more about like people doing the best they can. This is not about like intentional harm being exchanged. But that being said, think when you kind of experience that on the sort of chronic level for years at a time, there's a lot of sort of mirroring that happens in your internal life that says you deserve that that's what you're worth or not worth, right? So I think that's really kind of where my origin story begins. And I think that's why I resonated so much as I, made those prison visits and talking with my client and really kind of getting a backstory of why he even did what he did. And I think that's so much of what is missing in like our criminal punishment system. We don't care about people's stories. We just get to sort of the end result. Oh, this horrible thing took place, and therefore you should just disappear from the face of the earth.
Right. Yeah. What would the world look like if all of us were just judged by the worst thing that we did, right? But it's just, that's not the case. It's just with a few, right? And thank you so much for your vulnerability there in sharing that. But I think it's important for people to know that it's the empathy grows from having experienced difficult situations. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. And Eileen, that was definitely good. So let's talk a little bit about, I know that there was a particular movie that influenced you in terms of you going into law and some of the work. And I would love for you to talk about Hotel Rwanda, because it's such an impactful and powerful movie. But would love to hear you explain that or tell our listeners that story.
Yeah. So I was an English major at UCLA many moons ago, and really wasn't sure about like my end goal. Did I want to land in sort of teaching or, screenwriting, maybe the film industry, and happened to get this internship with a film production company in West Hollywood, and basically heard the producer one day yelling at his assistant that, you know, we're not in this movie, or we're not in this business to make good movies. We're in this business to make good money. And so in the midst of that disillusionment, I recall sort of hearing about a genocide happening in a region of Sudan called Darfur, and you know, Hotel Rwanda came out sort of around that time. And, you know, so it's just sort of very timely, like this idea that history was literally repeating itself, and not a lot of people had even heard of Darfur and didn't know what was going on. And just this idea that we were letting it happen again. And for me, obviously, this triggers that feeling of like, here's an entire people who are not being seen. I know what that feels like, right? So I start like kind of like learning more and trying to read books and things. And so it became this kind of shift from like this interest in the film industry toward more like law and justice. And so I started Googling, right? I started kind of trying to figure out like, what do people need in order to get hired by the UN? And basically the baseline was to have a law degree. So basically set my eyes on law school. And for me, I will never forget the scene in Hotel Rwanda where reporters are doing an interview with one of the UN peacekeepers, right? And just kind of talking about how there's, you know, having a hard time keeping the violence at bay and protecting these people. And they're just not really intervening to stop the terror that they're experiencing in the midst of that civil war. And the UN peacekeeper basically just said, we're peacekeepers, not peacemakers. And so, you know, right in line with the title of your podcast, right, this idea of peacemaking is just more proactive than peacekeeping. And I think America is really good at peacekeeping, right? They're not about rocking the boat. They don't want to like brush up any feathers. They just want to keep the status quo. And I think if we're going to be peacemakers, then it has to be more about really making sure that like real life, like actual direct change is happening. People's needs are being met. And yeah, so I remember watching that film. I remember making that verse from the Beatitudes about blessed are the peacemakers, like my verse at the time. Like that was really huge because I was like, I'm not being a peacekeeper. I'm going to be a peacemaker. And it was a whole thing. So that's kind of, yeah, that was a sounding board for my legal career.
Wow. No, that's so good. It's fascinating how different movies, books, just different things can impact us and actually push us and pull us to where we're supposed to be.
For sure.
You know, so that's just really, really cool. So I'm just wondering, we're doing this interview, it's a week or so after everything that's happened in our country, the insurrection on our nation's capital. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, where were you when you heard about that, and what were your initial thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I was working from home, as I've been doing actually for the past 4 or 5 years now. So just in my little apartment by myself, kind of watching these events unfold. My initial thoughts, I think if there's any way to sort of paint this image of like disjointed thoughts or just kind of this disorientation, right? Right. I remember, going on Instagram, watching this live of, I don't know if people know, but Jhenea FutureCon, they are a gender nonconforming activist and the international ambassador for BLM's network. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just sort of seeing what they had to say, because they were kind of at least watching the news when I couldn't, I got no TV. So I think for me, you know, what's so funny is in the midst of the different emotions, though, I wasn't surprised at all.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. I actually spent the holidays thinking a lot about abolition, like literally just in my mind, reimagining what this world is supposed to look like. You know, mm-hmm. in a world where there is justice and there is peace, what would that world look like in detail? And sort of what are my contributions to that end? And yeah, in terms of watching the images and these people kind of like climbing the walls, right, which is so ironic when they think that walls can keep people out of certain countries. You know, like I actually kept going back to the quote by Assata Shakur. It like if it were a verse in the Bible, it'd be my life verse. But right, she says, it is our duty to fight for freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and protect one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains. And I just kept thinking about, we have to protect each other now. This is real. There is no going back to whatever normal we thought, because normal is how we got here in the first place, as Future would also say. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's just a lot to be said for how these white supremacists, right, these domestic terrorists have essentially promised us more violence. That is in our future, you know, whether we like it or not. And so I just kept thinking about, what's the one after this, right? Because this, this is one thing, this is shocking and all the things, and everyone's kind of just like feeling the feelings. But in my mind, I think, and so much again comes from like the personal context of like having experienced trauma and having sort of that survivor mentality, I immediately go into like, how am I gearing up for the next thing? I think all I know is that we don't have a government that's going to protect us. That's just plain and simple. Mm-hmm. This is about people who had the support of politicians on the inside, as well as law enforcement. You know, I mean, it's such a travesty, such a joke. So we are really all we have. The people who are part of fighting for the liberation of the people, we protect each other. And so I think at this point now, it's about mentally preparing for a future where more incidents like these are going to happen.
I hear you. I so agree with you that I was not surprised by what happened. It definitely, you know, rocked me. You know, I mean, just to actually see the footage of, like you said, people climbing the wall, people slamming, you know, breaking open windows, and, you know, just taking siege of the nation's capital. When some people say, well, what do you mean you weren't surprised? For me, you know, back in October, I've been playing out different scenarios of if Trump wins, what's this country going to be like with him having a second term? And if Biden wins, what's it going to be like having a second term? And I got to tell you, I mean, the my conclusion was, I was concerned about Black bodies. I was concerned about people of color.
Absolutely.
Like, no matter what the outcome was going to be, that was one of the scenarios that I couldn't undo, so to speak. So when that incident happened last week or 10 days ago, whenever it was, it was terrorizing.
Yes,
for sure. But it just wasn't like, oh my God, I cannot believe that happened. Mm-hmm. It was within the realm of possibility, at least for me.
Absolutely.
That could be something that could happen. Obviously, everyone has, you know, hope beyond hope that it doesn't and that it didn't happen, but it did. And so now where do we go from here? You know? Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. To echo Dr. King on his birthday.
Right. Right. Aaron, go ahead. You're going to say something.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. I was not surprised at all. It's shocking, of course, to watch, but not surprised. You had said that probably this is not going to end here. We don't go back to normal, quote, normal after this. Mm-hmm. How could it, right? Like, things keep happening and they just keep getting worse. So you said that now we need to mentally prepare for the next thing that's going to happen. How is it? What does that entail? Mentally preparing?
Yeah. You know, honestly, I think that's not something that I know off the top of my head. I think for me, it's about kind of getting back into that learning posture, right? Sort of sitting at the virtual feet of activists, organizers, people on the ground, and really centralizing the voices kind of closest to the problem. And that's often going to be women of color, trans women of color, right? You know, like some of these demographics that we don't think about. And yet they clearly know more because, you know, the more oppressed and marginalized a person becomes, they see like systemic problems more clearly, you know, sort of in the same way that they are diamonds because they've endured the most pressure. So I think it's really about pressing into that and seeing what they have to say. I sort of am constantly watching sort of what BLM does and their leaders. And I think too, you know, the work that I can do for me is honestly kind of surrendering any sort of like superficial dreams or wishes. Some of these things that don't matter, right? I'm not saying like to throw away your dreams. I'm saying like some of these like kind of trivial things that we thought were the stuff of life, and they're just not anymore. Because here we've said in this country, you know, two things you never talk about. It's not polite to, you know, have these discussions at the dinner table, right? Race and politics, religion, you know, all these things, like that whole pot. And I think the not talking about it, at least in some form or fashion, has gotten us here. So now it's too late. Yes. We're now in a rush of trying to talk about these things. Meanwhile, people are dying. And that is just kind of really this reality of where we're at, you know. It is a state of war. And I think from kind of the Korean American context, I know a little bit about sort of my motherland being in a constant state of war, but it's a stalemate, right? Like a ceasefire. They're not actually kind of like taking up arms or anything, but they're not at peace. And so I think in the same way, we've kind of find ourselves in a civil war, actually, that we as liberators are trying to end. This is not like, oh, the fear of like, oh, like another civil war, like part two is going to happen. No, no, no. We're already in one. We're trying to end it.
Oh, no. You know, oftentimes, like when people think about Asians, they think of one type of person. All Asians are the same. So you have mentioned about being Korean. Can you talk about that Korean experience?
Oh man, I have to say it's relatively new, as ironic as that sounds. I've been in this body for 33 years, but to kind of enter into full integration of like the fullness of my identity as far as my Koreanness, that's really kind of been an endeavor in maybe the last year, if that. Really, really kind of new. So I think for me, I have to kind of say, I think it was 2019. I was at a 2.0 workshop, right, at Fellowship Church. And part of that day included people like splitting off into their affinity groups, right? All the Blacks, Whites, like Latinx and Asians kind of being their different corners and then kind of talking amongst themselves. What do they value about their communities? I was crawling out of my skin. I mean, I just was looking at the Black and brown tables and I was like, I really want to go to one of those two. And I cannot stand just the fact that I was walking to the corner I was walking to. And for so many years, it was just me kind of seeing myself through white eyes. You know, I felt superior in a lot of ways. I had bought into the lies and into the stereotypes of what Asians were all about. Oh my God, they're all like materialistic. They love money. They just care about like outward appearances and your presentation, your performance. There's nothing substantive about their heart or their soul. And what a demonic thing, like, you know, that kind of just destructive perspective to have about not only your people, but like your own self, my own self. And so to come out of that, and then I think it was literally February 2020, I'm sitting in the room and John was actually there for this. And we're talking about the concept of Han, right? Which in Korean is kind of this idea of like extreme heartache and pain from suffering, and particularly unjust suffering. And something in my world just cracked. I really felt like I had spent years, you know, like loving and admiring and really in some ways appropriating like the cultures of the Black and Brown communities and the ways in which they expressed their pain. I said to myself, these are people who get it. You know, when they experience oppression, they know how to sing it out. They know how to like go into like creative mode and do all these things. And I loved them for that. And I appreciated sort of the gift of being able to kind of delve into those other worlds. But when I was doing that, I was simultaneously rejecting myself and what my community potentially had to offer. I assumed my community had nothing to offer me. But here was this word, hun, that is so deeply embedded in the Korean culture. And I'd forgotten, like I literally had buried that inside of me for years. I could think in the moment when we were talking about that, right? February 2020, it took me back to when I was in junior high. And that's when I first learned about hun. And it was a Korean movie, seeing a movie again, kind of on that topic of just like, this brother and sister, and they're singing in pansori, this idea of like singing out that pain. It's actually like a type of art out there. And I remember being so fascinated by this concept, and I wanted to hear more about it. And I asked my mom to kind of, you know, share with me what it meant. And she did, but she also did say, you know, like to an extent, you want to kind of leave that alone. Don't kind of go too deep into sort of the darkness of that pain, you know? And so I kind of did. I just sort of left it alone and then sort of forgotten it. But I think when I heard it again, you know, all this time later, I really felt like when I sort of went to all reaches of like cultures and studying and just trying to find ways to like release the pain that I felt inside, I didn't have to go that far. I had to only look at like myself and the culture and the people that I come from. And it was right there all this time. And something about that really just broke my heart. That all of that time and that energy was lost, you know? And so I think now it's kind of then grown into this thing of like knowing my history of oppression, because I think to be able to stand in solidarity rightly with other marginalized communities, I have to know who I am and where I come from. And I have to say, in the midst of this pandemic, I've really kind of made it into a space of like self-study. Again, this idea of like, who were the people in my lineage? You know, I have an activist, I have a founder of a church, you know, like some of these people, I didn't even think about, and I'm starting to ask questions like, about sort of like the people in my line who made me and thinking too about like my grandmother who lived through the Japanese colonization, right? She was not allowed to speak Korean. She had to learn Japanese. And so for me, there's so much to draw from. It was like finding this like this fountain of life, literally, that I hadn't tapped into until, you know, this ripe old age of 33. So it's just been like it's crazy. I feel like there's a rebirth there that I'm experiencing in this time. And it's just such a unique place to be. And I think now it really kind of helps contextualize the things I've been feeling all this time, right? Sort of the patriarchy, the trauma that comes from being silenced, or just even within like church context, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for how churches of color look up to the American church, right? Like it's not just like the American church is just sort of what it is, but like it takes sort of like this global stage, literally, you know, across the sea, you have Korea sort of looking to America and how they do church, you know, because they see that it works in terms of like a marketing or a business level, right? So I think when that responsibility is taken, then we see, oh, like it's not just kind of my culture that has, absolutely. Like this idea of patriarchy and sort of colorism and classism. But there's a lot of ways in which some of that is because we're mimicking how America does things. So
yeah,
all that to say.
Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. That's good. I want to stay with Han because you and I have had a number of conversations, Eileen, about Han. Mm-hmm. And we actually were going through and reading a book.
Yes.
You had recommended The Wounded Heart of God. And I just want to read a quote. I literally have this up on my computer screen. So I was glad you raised it. But Andrew Sung Park says that Han can be defined as the critical wound of the heart generated by unjust psychosomatic repression, as well as by social, political, economic, and cultural oppression. It is entrenched in the hearts of the victims of sin and violence and is expressed through such diverse reactions as sadness, helplessness, hopelessness, resentment, hatred, and the will to revenge. Han reverberates, and this is the last part, Han reverberates in the souls of survivors of the Holocaust, Palestinians in the occupied territories, victims of racial discrimination, battered wives, children involved in divorce, the victims of child molestation, laid off workers, the unemployed, and exploited workers. So it's just this, I just remember us having that conversation, not just with you and me, but there are some other folks from different ethnicities. Mm-hmm. And we were all trying to figure out what are the words within each of our cultures that actually describes what I just read from Dr. Andrew, which is this notion of Han. Talk just a little bit more, because this is really good. And then we're going to get into the silence part, because I really want to jump into that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you said so much in that. I want to try and unpack some of that. But I wanted our listeners at least to have a clean definition of Han for you. So you heard that. But for you, how do you express, you know, if you're defining Han to someone?
Yeah. So you mean by definition, sort of my personal definition, correct?
Or even your expression. I mean, I loved how, just to elaborate a little bit more, even how you said you would look at other like Black and brown folks and see how they were expressing their pain through song, through poetry, through creative ways, through academic ways. For you, once you kind of came to this revelation of like, I'm Korean and I experienced this deep pain, how has that like formed you now? Because that was almost a year ago that we had that conversation.
Right.
And we've had many more since then.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think I initially remember kind of appreciating spirituals, you know, sort of like as an elementary school student and kind of really loving some of these songs, like Wading in the Water and what have you. And I think it was such a release, some of the ways in which like, Black or brown communities have engaged with their pain in sort of an artistic form. And I think I really resonate with creative, like, and performative art in that way, because there's definitely like an artistic side of me. And I, so I remember as a kid, I would, I would be reading a Rosa Parks biography. I would be writing poetry about white settlers taking the land of indigenous people, you know, in some way. I mean, these were all in my mind, very sort of silent ways, but little ways that I could, right? Just as like as a young person, just kind of navigating some of these thoughts I had, like literally would like walk home from school, like thinking about like the things that I was learning. And it just like so bothered, so sort of like feeling kind of the water within my soul sort of being shaken by that. But I think now sort of fast forward to like discovering this whole world that is fully my own. And I want to really emphasize that. I think people really underestimate how activism is about like the celebration of life, the fullness of who you are. your full identity. And when you embrace that, that's what we're championing in the people we're trying to fight for, you know, because it's the demonization of certain aspects of our identities that really has been ramped up into violence, into threatening us into premature death. Right. So now for me, I think I've been really sort of sitting with the historical portion of like, yeah, what it is to be Korean, reading books on Korean history, watching historical dramas, you know, but then kind of really placing now new sort of images in my mind of what it was for like Japanese soldiers to infiltrate a country that was not theirs and really like in no way being ashamed of it, just like trying to make us a particular country disappear. Everything from the currency, yeah, right, to making Korean currency like worthless basically, and then infusing like Japanese money into kind of their financial system, to the language, not being able to speak it, to like, yeah, just I think because those images are so new to me, and then knowing that like I have had grandparents who lived through that, it's just, it, man, talk about like meeting yourself for the first time, really, you know. And right, so much of this work, as I say, like delves into self-examinations, self-awareness, self-love. This is all critical because this is exactly what's been denied to people who are at the margins, people who have been oppressed. It's an erasure of who they are, mm-hmm, to say you are less than human, you don't belong, you are, you know, X, Y, and Z, you don't fit the mold because of this, and therefore that's, this is how we get to treat you, essentially. So, yeah, I think for the expression portion, I think in, watching some of those historical dramas, like I've actually gotten my language back. And I remember sharing this with John, right? This idea of, I literally lost the Korean language from my tongue when I went to law school, right? I was in Boston. Mm. I was with all these other kids, man, who were like generations of jurists, right? Just privileged, predominantly white and male, like mom's a lawyer, dad's a lawyer, you know, grandpa's a lawyer, all the things. I'm the first, you know, at least in my particular line. And so I felt like I had to put it aside. They're like, I mean, my English is not that great anyway, you know what I mean? I had to like, I'm sitting there having to work twice as hard to keep up, like at least be half as good as these other kids. So I just felt like there is no point in this, yeah, engaging with kind of that part of my identity. But now I can feel it back on my tongue. It comes easily to me now. It's showing up in my dreams and my thoughts. It's coming up in like my conversations with my parents. They're probably like, what the hell's going on with her, you know? It's super refreshing. And I think for the most part, I have to say, again, because of like my particular affinity for like the Black and Brown communities, I actually was trying to learn Spanish. That was something that I was like trying to like put on my tongue, because I felt like it could bring me closer, you know? And I think now there's something about language being tied to a whole world, but this one's mine. Yeah. I'm telling you, man, like if you're a listener of color out there and you don't sort of have that connection to your native language, you're missing an entire world that belongs to you. You have the keys. You just got to put it in and unlock that door, you know? And this is literally something that I've kind of experienced for myself in the last few months. It's brand new.
You made a statement earlier that was really interesting. You said that the Asian American churches, they look up to American churches. And I agree. I never really thought that complete thought. But when you think about an Asian American church or an Asian church, you think about them being very conservative, mm-hmm, right? Because it's probably them thinking that this is the way the American church is. So we need to be highly conservative. And in the process of becoming a very conservative church, you lose all of that freedom, right? Mm. Freedom to be expressive, freedom to sing loudly and shout and, you know, just praise at the top of your lungs? Because I know I did. I remember going to those Asian churches and having to sing like this and feeling so nervous about not sounding like this. But now that I go to a church that has many people and I see the different ways that people are praising, I love the fact that I can sing really loud, really bad, but really loud and just full of joy, right? Because I think that something I realized is, you know what? You don't have to sound perfect, because no matter what, I will sound beautiful in God, to God's ears, no matter how bad or off key I am. And I know I am, but just right. The ability to be free is so awesome. And I think that that's something that a lot of Asian Christians really struggle with, right? That freedom and having to fit into this mold, this tight mold of what it is to try to be an American Christian.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would even like argue to say, and to add to that, and I appreciate you sharing, man, I think the Asian or Asian American churches have really mimicked the American church's anti-Blackness, right? I mean, some of this idea of like, you know, everything else they do sounds so good. But when it comes to, you know, sort of like diversity or, you know, not even just diversity, but kind of like the fact that we are equal in humanity, equal in being the Imago Dei, the image of God, it's just not something that's fully registered yet, right? I mean, I think, man, there's so many factors that come into play. Because we're talking about now what is the older generation of those who had actually immigrated to this country. That's who kind of like fills up the pews of some of these Asian American churches. So it becomes not only race and gender, but it becomes generational. Because the dialogue then is kind of broken. You have sort of like, they grew up without the internet. I mean, the internet for me sort of showed up in like high school, like, you know, some of these things. So it's really kind of a testament to how, you know, especially, man, when we get into sort of like how legalistic the American church can be, you know, how pharisaical it really is at the end of the day, despite what they may say, you know, from the pulpit. It's kind of this idea that they are so like just in love with and in bed with their like archaic traditions, right? That they can wave American flags and the cross at the same time. And they think it's the same damn thing. You know, then in a similar way that you're going to have sort of churches who are then churches of color who are looking up to the American church sort of following suit. You know, I see them trying as hard as they can to assimilate, to be as American as possible, to sort of like, you know, and obviously that plays into the model myth, or model minority myth, rather. There's just a lot to be said for that, you know, and it's super destructive to cultures that have nothing wrong with them, quite frankly, you know, but this idea that we place into the minds of like communities of color that something is missing. You don't got what we got. So you got to try either your hardest to be like us or just stay out of our way. Right. And you can't do that to people. You can't shut out life like that. And for me, what's so infuriating about the American church is that they are acting like every other American institution when we're supposed to be different. They say that we're supposed to be different. But man, that is just such a stark contrast to how church really plays out in this country.
Yeah. No, that's good. Thank you for that. Earlier, you talked a little bit about silencing. And I want to talk about that, especially in conjunction with the fact that you're now writing a book, or you've finished writing a book. And just talk a little bit. I think this aspect is really interesting. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Oh, man. There's something to be said about like sitting down in front of a blank page, you know, and the terror that brings. But I think all the more so when there is that history of silencing. And, you know, because it's one thing for silence to be imposed by another person. It's another thing when enough time passes and that voice becomes your voice. Then you're telling yourself to shut up. you know? And that's really some of the dark, twisted, like, sin of it all. But I think it all kind of flows together. Activism has taught me to make space for myself, that I get to take up some space for a change, right? And that I deserve sort of just that room to be free to express what's inside. And I think you both know this. I'm bursting at the seams, man. I'm just so sick of being in my corner that I've lived in for decades. But at the same time, because I'm so used to that corner, I'm terrified of what it means to not live in that world. Because I really feel like, and I think some of this is informed by my experience with working with those who are incarcerated, man, we adapt to anything. We will sit there and normalize a cage, you know, and it starts feeling safe. It starts feeling comfortable. But at the same time, thank God, there's something in our heart that says, don't stay there. You know, get up, you know, get out, because the soul starts rotting, you know, and like, and I think there's this internal conflict that starts happening where your comfort is being like pushed and, you know, kind of what we see mirrored in our sort of collective conscious now of just like the status quo being pushed and resisted against with like this idea that change needs to happen. That's true for a nation. That's true for an individual. So I think for me, as I say, writing this book was very much a communal endeavor. I really looked to that circle of people as like a second family when they were able to cheer on really something that was stolen from me a long time ago. You know, and I'm not talking about people stealing that, but we're really the enemy, you know? And it's no surprise to me because I think the enemy had it out for my voice in particular from a very early age, right? That's the first thing he attacked. And that's sort of like his go-to thing with me. So I think it's just constantly being able to give yourself a chance to trust yourself. And I think the more you do it, the better you get at it. But it's super hard because I think it's sort of this idea of letting go, you know, because, I mean, well, there are pros and cons to everything. And I think it's true. I mean, the cage is comfortable. It's what I'm used to. And so using my voice, speaking out, being met with resistance, perhaps, these are all going to be uncomfortable, you know, sort of unfamiliar experiences. But that the freedom that you were waiting for, that's where it's at. Right. And I think especially if we're going to say that we believe in Jesus, then you're not doing it alone, you know. And that's sort of like the illusion, the aloneness of it, that it's just you, man. You're just like everyone else is doing fine. You're the only one with problems like that. That is just the functioning lie in the midst of all that. And so for me, it has been such a fight. You know, activism is hard as it is when it comes to sort of the external and showing up with your body on the line at protests. But it's another thing to do it for yourself in your soul. And honestly, that's where it begins.
Yeah. You know, I want to know, just because I think that the most effective activists are the ones that are driven powerfully by the passions that fuel them, right? And you definitely are passionate about standing up for those that need people to stand up for them. How do you balance yourself? Because it can become, it can eat you up, right? Mm. So I want to know how you do that.
Yeah, that's so good. There's a particular passage actually that I enjoy every time I look at it. So I will share if y'all don't mind. So it's in Luke chapter 13, verses 31 to 33. I'll just go ahead and read it. At that time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, "Leave this place and go somewhere else. Herod wants to kill you." He replied, "Go and tell that fox, I will keep on driving out demons and healing people today and tomorrow, and on the third day, I will reach my goal. In any case, I must press on today and tomorrow and the next day." Go and tell that fox, right? I mean, Jesus has this way of like meeting people's needs directly when he talks about driving out demons and healing people. And he's not deterred by the threat of state-sanctioned violence. You know, that's basically what it is. And I think for me, the grounding sort of comes in breathing, right? Sort of kind of coming back to like, man, I think I saw somewhere today, like we've lost 2 million people worldwide from the coronavirus, but I'm breathing. Wow. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and I think it's a painful reality. And I honest to God wish I didn't have to live through this time, but I think we were born at exactly the time that we were, so we could be alive at this particular time for a reason. And I think that's only because God believed in us, you know, like we believe in him, but he believes in us, you know, to kind of show up and be sort of all that he's made us to be in this time, as ridiculously scary as it is. And so I think the breathing for me is just kind of like a centering of like, I'm still here, you know, and I'm going to make it too, you know, not to sort of say one way or the other about like a particular time for my passing, but like this idea of like, man, God has a design for all of this. He has intentions behind not just sort of the way he orchestrates situations, but people. And like, as I say, like the internal workings of like who we are at a soul level. And so I think there's that. I think for me, it's about life-giving friendships with those who are like-minded, right? I got a couple friends who I'm like in contact with nearly every day. And these are the things that we say to each other. We're alive. We're going to get through this. We have each other, right? And that's kind of reminiscent of, again, Assata Shakur's quote about we must love and protect one another. It's about us. It's about us kind of, you know, yeah, being shoulder to shoulder with the ones who are in this work and fighting for those who are at the margins. So there's that. And I think, again, kind of tapping into the creative side of me. So more poetry writing, more doing art. I use like oil pastels and stuff. And then playing the piano, playing the cello. I'm literally taking virtual piano lessons, which is really funny. I'm probably like my teacher's oldest student. but, you know, all of this stuff as a way of saying, like, again, when we talk about entering into this work as our full selves, this is like, in a sense, trying to use every part of who I am, from my breathing to the right half of my brain. That's the creative side. Like, you know, bringing all of that into play, because I'm going to need all of it. All of this stuff, you know, from the breathing to the community to the art, it's all going to become tools in my toolbox for what liberation needs, you know, like for this movement, because everything kind of comes down to what are you going to bring? What are you going to contribute? Right. Women says, what will your verse be? Like that whole idea. And so if anything, it may feel like it's not productive or it's not doing anything, but the resting for the soul, adding color to your life, all of these things are actually going to gear you up even more for the work.
So Eileen, if there was, what's one question that you would recommend that people should be asking themselves now, especially in this moment? Like if you're going to give some advice to people, it's like, what should I be thinking about? What should I be asking myself?
Yeah. So I would say to listeners, especially if they're listeners of color, to orient your questions towards self-examination first. I know that may sound less urgent sort of than what you see in the news at the moment, and you want to just sort of get out there and, you know, roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty. But I really think there's a lot to be said for stepping back. You know, get like roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty in you, in the inner workings of you. Because I think there's a lot of danger, actually, if you enter into this work without having done that sort of like self-awareness kind of inventory, and then just going out there, not knowing what mess you're bringing out into the world. And you may actually contribute to the damage, right? I mean, that's like a real sort of factor to consider. So I think a few questions that come to mind would be, what are you most afraid of? Do you truly love every aspect of your identity, right? Do you allow yourself to take up that space?
So we got cut off, Eileen, And I know you had some additional questions that you want people to be asking themselves, in particular people of color. So go for it.
Yeah. So it was just the last question that I had thought of was to really sort of delineate for yourself, right? And start filtering some of these American church traditions and kind of expectations, I would say. And what does it mean for you to be the church in these revolutionary times? Because I think what the church is offering, whether it's some of these like programs and, you know, just some of these Sunday functions or just sort of these archaic notions of like centralizing a homily. Why do we still do that? You know, I could say a lot about that. But I think if you really try to strip away all of that junk from your faith and what you understand the heart of Jesus to be, what he calls you to be, what is he asking of you to be in this time? Because whether you like it or not, you're here. But I also did want to say something specifically to church leaders. So I'm going to say it like this. Listeners should lead and leaders should listen. You as a leader, what are you doing to seek out and listen to and elevate the voices that are the most marginalized in the room, right? Don't be afraid of the people's questions. This is what I really want to get at. Some of the fear that I see from the top. If you are sort of being the example of what we should be emulating, address the fear part, right? So maybe some of these questions are for you then, right? Like the whole, what am I most afraid of? Like start with number one. But also, I think stop avoiding politics or what, you know, like the thing in your mind that is this fixed box of politics. Never talk about that. And you just like kind of move it to the corner. Bring that box back out, you know? Because your silence is political. Your silence is political. You're making a statement anyway. And Jesus was making political statements all the time, you know, at the very least to the Roman Empire and to the religious leaders of the time, but at the very most, obviously, to the kingdom of darkness. So everything, you know, including the silence is political. So don't back away from that. That's all I would say.
So good. So good. I really appreciate that. How can people reach you if they want to reach out and ask questions or engage with you?
Yeah. So I have recently joined Instagram. I mean, we're talking about maybe a month or two, so I am green. and yeah, so that is a way. I can't believe I'm saying it, but it's true. The username or whatever people call it is
Instagram handle.
Oh, thank you. See, there you go. Things I don't know. Add that to list. at Fire Flower Abolitionist, all one word. Fire Flower Abolitionist.
Sounds good. Okay. I need to ask this question because you've mentioned that word a couple of times and we have we've danced kind of around it. So it's part of your Instagram handle, the whole concept of abolitionist. What does that mean for you? Why do you use that term?
Yeah. Oh, man. So talking about disruptive peacemaking, I think the essence of peace is abolition, right? So specifically the abolition of police and prisons, and not just police forces, you know, or like sheriff's departments. I'm talking about policing, the practice of it. And it shows up in multiple arenas, right? It's like in how we do like correctional supervision, right? Parole and probation, like civil commitments of people being put into psychiatric hospitals, to the foster care system, all of that. So, but those two practices of incarceration and policing are historically rooted in white supremacy. And to this day, as we've seen from the insurrection last week, that it's still embedded within the current system. So for me, okay, again, asking people to put their fear of this topic aside. And to kind of go there with me a little bit, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's not about absence. you know, right. And that's kind of obviously people are like, oh, like, well, that's the definition of abolition. You're taking something out. No, but it's actually about presence, right? So it's about generative work in the sense that when we are prioritizing, say, funding for community needs, mm-hmm. and we're talking about good job opportunities, not just adequate or like survival wage job opportunities, but like good job opportunities, good housing, good education, and funneling like city funds in that direction, as opposed to, again, police or to our prison system, then that is the work of abolition. When you add and you contribute to good and, again, preserving, promoting life for the community, for the people, then you are simultaneously abolishing like systems in place that are meant to cause premature death. And I say that because part of the definition of racism that's actually put forth by Ruth Wilson Gilmore, she's kind of like a veteran abolitionist out there, like a big name in that world. She talks about systemic racism leading primarily and first and foremost to premature death. That's kind of what this is about. This is shortening the lives of marginalized people. And what we're trying to say is when we abolish the systems that want to do that to a certain set of people in the name of law enforcement, right? It's basically social control is what that is. You don't look like us, you don't think like us, then you're out. We don't need you, you know? And then, but at the same time, we love your labor. So we will use your bodies and then throw you away. But abolition is to say, we're not choosing to live that way. We are going to reimagine a new world where that mentality, that like principality, if I can say so, it's utterly that demonic, it has no place in a world where people, children, I mean, we're all meant to thrive. This includes all of us. And if we lose out on Black liberation, we all lose out on liberation, right? This is a collect, like we're all kind of chained to one another in that way, where it's like, we can't sort of compartmentalize who we are, again, as like a nation or as individuals, to say, I like this part of our identity, right, individual or collective, but I don't like that part. And we're just going to like, you know, gerrymander our kind of our world. But abolitionists basically are saying it's about presence. It's about doing everything right. If we funneled all of our attention and our heart into, yeah, revitalizing our education system, right? And just all the other sort of social services and support systems that are out there, then what need is there really going to be for police, for incarceration? There won't really be that need, right? You know, and so for people who are like, that's just crazy talk, I mean, like, you're just basically asking for like rapists and killers to run rampant. Here, what I'm going to say is this. There are neighborhoods that already exist in an abolitionist world, right? We're talking about predominantly white, predominantly affluent communities that are, they don't see the police unless they're called for, right? Those public school systems, before the pandemic, at least, they were not kind of being TSA'd with, like, you know, like a security check and everything else just to get into their classrooms. This world exists and is possible, but why do we say it's impossible then for communities of color, right? What you're then really saying is it's a reflection of your value system. Mm-hmm. At least be just like, this is, this is my thing. Just be honest about it. If you say you don't like us, that you don't want us to live, you don't want us to thrive, you don't want us to have access to resources, just say that. Don't be nice about it. Don't give me your respectability politics, right? And this, like, let's just rush into reconciliation. No, you don't get to have that, right? Because if you, if you're sitting there talking about peace and talking about reconciliation, but you're not talking about truth or justice, there's no conversation, right? So either be honest about really kind of like the thing in your heart, right? Take a look in the mirror. What's really there? That dark little thing, right? The kind of ugliness that actually says, like, those people are less than human to me, and I'm going to treat them as such. if you're not going to like fully own that, right, then this is just like, man, like dancing in circles. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're just kind of creating insanity for ourselves. So that is all to say, I will get off my soapbox. Abolitionists and abolitionists are basically saying, we don't have to live like this, right? That's an Andre Henry thing. It doesn't have to be this way. It's just about giving everybody what they need, what they deserve, right? Because all of us in our fullness, in every aspect of our identity, from gender to race, even to our age, right? The time we were born in, the generation that we find ourselves in, that's all allowed. We're all allowed to be all of ourselves.
Yeah. Whew, that's good. Thank you. I'm glad we got a chance to have you jump on your soapbox, and you can jump on your soapbox anytime for sure. So this has been an amazing conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're so welcome. Yeah, thank you guys so much for creating space for me, voices like mine. There's so many more out there, you know?
Yes.
So this is
we just plan on having more of those voices for sure. For sure.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. This has been the Disruptive Peacemakers Podcast. We'll see you the next time we're on. Bye-bye.
Bye. Disruptive Peacemakers.